Session number 27342, Reel 6.
Jack Thomas, Reel 6.
Well, as I was saying, I joined J Flight of A36 Squadron on the motor vessel Alexia, which was a tanker, and set off on our first convoy. We sailed across from we picked up the convoys off the north coast of Ireland, across the Atlantic, and it was quite a long journey. I mean, it was 2 or 3 weeks because the convoys are quite slow. Some of them, we actually had a 9-knot convoy, which and you had to keep to that speed of the convoy. But then we would they'd zigzag all over the place as well. Sometimes they'd go north about, sometimes south about, depending on where the information was about the U-boats. Of course, we didn't realise at the time, but the commodore of the convoy obviously had Enigma information, and they knew more or less where the U-boats were, so they could direct us in on our flights into the right position, which of course the ideal thing, keep them underwater, because if they didn't like the idea of aeroplanes flying around over them. And we did these various kinds of flights, which I mentioned, the names of crocodiles, lizards and vipers and so on. The one we didn't like particularly was the one when you're astern of the convoy, because, and let me point out, my aircraft would probably... it was a pretty old one, the one I had, this one, the Dingbat I called it. It had we had a picture on the side of a black cat in goggles riding a rocket with the Dingbat underneath. That was this insignia. Anyway, it had been flying for years, and it would only do about 75 knots with a full load of depth charges or rockets. And its service ceiling was somewhere about 600 feet. So I never actually wore a parachute because I was never high enough to jump. Not that there would be any good jumping in the Atlantic anyway. I don't know much point about that. But when you were a long way astern of the convoy and the headwind got up, and you began to wonder as you watched the petrol gauge very, very carefully, because there's an awful lot of water between you and either shore when you get in the middle of the Atlantic. Anyway, I was fortunate enough and I had no trouble at all with the flying. We did our regular patrols across to Canada, where we went into Halifax, and the planes flew off and landed at Dartmouth Naval Air Station, which is the Canadian naval base on the opposite side of the shore of the river to Halifax.
What were the duration of the types of patrol you do, though?
Do about 2.5-3 hours, perhaps, something like that, about 3 hours. But that was really long enough, because you were getting pretty cold by then. It was, you know, you're getting stiffening up a bit. And also you had to make sure you had enough fuel in hand in case you adverse weather conditions, or in case the observer had missed a wind or something and you weren't quite on course. I still marvel at these observers, though, because what they did, you'd set off on a course, you know the direction of where you were sent to, but every now and again you'd drop, if it's daytime, a smoke float, or nighttime, a flame float, and you flew a particular course around this, and from this, a bit of timing and that, the observer could calculate the direction of the wind and its speed, and then he'd alter his course accordingly, because your air course and your ground course are not necessarily the same, and that's the thing. And then when you got to your patrol area, you'd carry out your patrol, whatever it was. Again, flying very accurately, you follow the observer's instructions about when you had to turn, onto what heading and so on. And if he said fly at a particular speed, if you could reach that speed, you kept to it precisely, because that was the only way of getting about, a dead reckoning navigation. There's no landmarks whatsoever, so you're relying entirely on what you calculated mathematically, as it were. And it was always very pleasant when you got back. On the distance you could see a bit of a haze, and there was a convoy. Very nice feeling, that.
You mentioned in night flying there was a sense of isolation.
Yes.
How was that feeling when you were out in the ocean?
Oh, well, very, very much the same, really, because, I mean, say you were just, you're watching your instruments and just doing as you were told from the chap in the back. And again there, you'd use flame floats to get the winds. You're very more careful about your flying. You could generally see the convoy at night because, I mean, although it was blackout, there were odd bits of lights appear, and there's the wake of the ships and that sort of thing. Any sort of a mood or good clear night, you could see the surface of the water. So it wasn't quite as lost as you might think. But both day and night flying, it was quite demanding, really. And I mean, I only did 2 or 3 convoy trips like that, but some people who did a lot, it must have been very, very tiring to do it over and over again. Every time I get back to the ship, I think, once more I've done it, you know, sort of thing.
Was the accommodation on board ship when you binge line? Where were you accommodated?
We had along the below the level of the flight deck. They'd built a series of cabins, and they usually had a pilot and observer together, a cabin, dual cabins, and the ratings had two or three mess decks down in the bows as well. The Merchant Navy ratings had their own cabins as well. It was all split up, but it wasn't too bad really. We liked it, and I think the people, the troops liked it, because they were away from any sort of bull or naval control. They had a job to do, and that's all they were asked to do, and they liked it. When we had any spare time, if the weather was suitable, we played a game which was slightly more dangerous than flying, which was called deck hockey. Now, deck hockey, you play with shinty sticks, and the puck is a rope grommet, that's a rope ring, soaked in aircraft dope to harden it. And I think the only rule I can remember was you were not allowed to hit anybody unless he had the puck or something like it. It was very limited. It's like a kind of mad hockey five-a-side. And actually, we had different teams. The pilots had a team. There were the three aircraft pilots. There was also one of the assistant air staff officer who was a pilot too. And there were the observers had a team, and the air gunners. And some of the Merchant Navy groups, like the stokers, would have a team, and the stewards. And we played this five-a-side hockey in a knockout competition all the way across the Atlantic. And knockout was quite a good word in it, because on one occasion, the air staff officer, who was a senior naval officer in charge, he's a lieutenant commander, he decided there was a bit of physical risk here, so we better have a sick berth attendant attending all these matches. Well, the sick berth attendant came up one day and stood by the bridge with his first aid box waiting to see what happened. Somebody raising his stick rather suddenly hit him in the temple and knocked him cold, so he refused to come again after that. We did have one person with shoulder charge went over the side, but he landed in an Ehrlichan gun pit about 6 feet down, so he was only bruised a bit. And my trouble was I played in goal. Well, in goal you wore full flying kit, as much as you could possibly get on, and you sort of lay across the entrance of the goal while they tried to pound the puck through your ribs. So it was quite a dangerous sport, really. I certainly think it wouldn't be accepted nowadays as a sport. But it was good fun, though. We played that.
And what was the kind of flying routine, leisure routine that you had on board ship?
Well, you'd probably have about something like two aircraft patrols in the morning and two in the afternoon as a normal thing. So you'd find that you usually flew once a day, sometimes twice a day. If there was a flap on, then they might get all the aircraft off at once. But normally they like to keep somebody on the ship so that if anything happened on the other side of the convoy, there's another aeroplane available. We were told where to go by the Commodore, as I say, and he gave the instructions for flying, how many hours we're to do, what particular patrols we're to fly. And as I say, the naval control was under a lieutenant commander, observer usually. He was in charge of all the naval personnel. And then there'd be either the six pilots and observers, or eight pilots and observers, depending on the type of ship, and the air gunners, and then the other people I mentioned, the Maritime ACAC people. Actually, it was rather funny, because the Maritime ACAC people were rather, they didn't like this idea of no discipline and none of this sort of thing. We had a very stiff little sergeant in charge, and he used to get his men to drill on the flight deck each day in full uniform with rifles, and all our lads would be howling their heads off and say, come on, get on with it there, your bongos, you know. And the worst thing of all was the armament. They had Ehrlichan guns on the side of the ship, but the main thing was they had I think it was a 9-pounder on the stern, and this gun had a date on it, 1912. So they have a practice firing one day, so they did. They fired this thing, and it came loose from its seating, so they couldn't use it again. So you imagine the ribald comments from the naval ratings, can't you? Oh, dear. But, there's a lot of fun in it as well. I mean, sometimes it's a bit hairy. If it was foggy, it wasn't very nice. We had a blind approach beacon system, BABS as it was called, which you could use if you came around from the stern of the ship. When you got towards the ship, you could pick up a Morse note, and you got a message. If you were directly in line with the ship, you got a steady note. On one side, you got a dot, the other a dash. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, you could work your way in like that. And that was quite successful, really. And as I said, on the trip when I was flying as a pilot, we didn't have any accidents at all. It was quite good there. And anyway, we came back to Maidout in Northern Ireland. Now, With a huge squadron like that, the administration was obviously very complicated. But what we didn't like was we were always splitting crews up, and you fly with an observer for a couple of months, and then you find he's sent with somebody else, and you were sent with another one. The air gunner went somewhere else, and we couldn't really understand this. But the apocryphal story was that in the sort of squadron office, there was a great big sheet of cardboard with slots in it, different coloured cards for like observers' names, pilots, air gunners. Ships' names, at sea, at port, whatever, on leave. And the record that the chap who used to clean the office, three badges, ordinary seaman, when he came in, he used to leave the door open sometimes, and the draft would blow some of these cards out. He'd just stick them back in the first holes he could find. Which probably grew out of the fact that the changes were so many, anyway.
But sounds a very strange squadron organisation.
Completely different from anything else, you see. As I say, if this had been an American Navy, they'd have had an admiral in charge of a 19 carrier sort of thing. And all we did, we had this two lieutenant commanders, a pilot and observer, who were in charge at Baydown. We had we had three. One was the CO, there was a senior pilot and senior observer. They had a lieutenant commander on each of the carriers as the naval personnel, and everybody else was just there. But it worked very well, really, in spite of that. And it was a kind of casual atmosphere about it, which was pleasant in some ways. Where I hear what some tales of some people, the trouble they had perhaps mixing with regular naval officers on Kai, where the captain was what we call a fish head, he wasn't an airman, and he didn't like the planes because they made the decks oily and that sort of thing, you know, regardless of the fact the ship was only there for the benefit of the planes. So we had none of that. We had the Merchant Navy people were absolutely delighted with having the carriers on the convoy because they kept the U-boats down. As I say, 200 convoys, and they only lost two ships. And actually, I was on one of the convoy where they did lose those two. One was a tanker, and one was an ammunition ship. And the ammunition ship blew up, and they only had about five casualties. They sort of blew apart, and everybody was in the sea. But the tanker, I think they lost a lot, because we could see it in the distance. It's awful, this. It caught fire, and its steering had gone. It went round in a big circle. And as it went round the circle, the flames, of course, just went across the deck. And when it came out of the flames, there was nobody there. I remember I went home on leave after that, and I went to... I was in Newcastle's bus station, going home to the village where I lived. And there was a queue for the dockyard workers of special buses that were going to Chesterley Street, which was near where I lived, you see. So I thought, well, handy, I'll get in that queue. And I went in the queue, and I got howled out by the... Get him out of here, you bloody bastard. This is for the workers, not for the likes of you, naval officers, they said. Kicked me out of the queue. And I thought, and there I'd be. I've just seen all those people killed on that trip, you know, to bring stuff so that they could do their job. To put me off of dockyard work for a long time, that, I must admit. Anyway, when we got back after the last trip in the Alexia, we split up. My observer went somewhere, and Egon went somewhere else, and I was told to join M Flight. M Flight was a three-plane flight from a tanker, CO, a chap called Dennis Shaw. Well, I couldn't understand. I thought, he's an old man, this. He was 24, married with a child. And I thought, fancy anybody as old as 24 still flying aeroplanes. It just shows relative age. You see, when you see a picture of a group of us sitting down there, you just look like six formers sitting in a row, and that's what we were, really. Anyway, I joined Dennis's flight. Now, it bothered me a bit because Dennis had a reputation for doing beat-ups of places in Echelon, you know, one place in Echelon. And he'd been used to a three-plane flight, and I was the fourth plane on the three-plane flight. So I thought, well, if he normally leaves enough room for three planes when he beats up the place, I hope he leaves enough room for me. So we went, joined Dennis, then joined this flight. And then the next day, he came to us. He said, I've just had a message. We're going on a special trip. He said, what's it all about? They haven't told me yet, but he said, the CO said, we're going to go on a carrier, and he mentioned a name, and I can't remember, it was the Boxer, the Bite, or the Battle. It was beginning with a B, one of those class carriers, and we're going out to the Mediterranean. So get all your kit together in cabin trunk, send it off, the troops will go with a lorry with the kit, they'll join the ship, and we'll catch them up later, you see. And so that was that. Then the next day we're due to go. In the morning, Dennis was in the heads, and the CO was peeing beside him, said, oh, by the way, Dennis, there's been a change of plans. You're joining Campania in the Clyde, not this other one. But Dennis said, but all the kit of the troops have gone off. Don't worry, said this, don't worry. It'll catch up with you. Like famous last words that was. Anyway, so we got in our planes, we took off, and we flew off to the Clyde. Sure enough, there was this carrier. We checked the letter on the deck. It was the right one. We flew round it, the circuit, to come in. It didn't turn into wind, so we beat him up. And again, and for about a quarter of an hour, then we could see, reluctantly, they turned into wind, you see. So we landed on 1, 2, 3, 4. And I was the last one on. And as I got up my plane, I could see Dennis talking to the captain on the deck further down. And Dennis came back looking rather crestfallen. I said, well, what is it? He said, well, he said to me, who the hell are you and what do you want? Which I thought was a wonderful start, anyway. So what had happened, apparently, was that the carrier normally carried a squadron of swordfish for anti-submarine work and a squadron of wildcats, Grumman martlets, for fighter protection. And his crew of swordfish crews had been sent ashore for a training exercise and a rest, because they'd done about 3 Russian convoys in succession, and the attrition was pretty bad. They'd lost about 20% of their crews. So and the carrier was needed for an action, and so he said, well, you better stay on board and act as our anti-submarine patrol, right? So we sailed up to towards Scapa Flow and joined up another carrier called the Trumpeter and half a dozen destroyers. And we did a raid on the Norwegian coast. And that was funny, because the Trumpeter had Grumman Avengers on. They were the American-built torpedo planes, and wildcats as well, like we had. And so the Avengers were actually mine-laying off Ardalsnes in Norway, down between the islands off the coast of Norway. The Germans used to transport an awful lot of shipping down there, and it was a good idea to stick a few mines in and catch them, you see. So they did some mine-laying, and the fighter boys went ashore and shot up a couple of aerodromes, and including one well-known fighter pilot called Ginger Buxton, who was a funny chap, this. He was from the Trumpeter. He was from our ship, that's right, he was, yeah. We went back on the Trumpeter afterwards. He ran out of ammunition shooting up a sort of a gunpoint on the end of a fjord somewhere, and there was a radio station there. So he dropped his deck hook and flew across to try and yank out the wire from the radio thing. As he came away from they opened up with a machine gun, he had noticed, and shot him up. So he came back trailing smoke back to the ships, and he ditched alongside he was lucky, he ditched alongside the rescue ship and got up at that side without getting his feet wet even. Madman Buxton. He was a funny chap, he was a very quiet, red-haired lad, almost very taciturn, didn't mix at all or say much, very quiet, a bit nervous, but in the air he was a demon. He was an ideal fighter pilot, really. He later on, after the war, went out to the Korean War. He had a job in Africa where he was on a long-term contract. He had 6 months leave, and he volunteered and went out in the Korean War for his holidays. Fought in, I think it was it? What is flying there? I think Seahawks or something like that, yes. Amazing chap. Anyway, that's to the side, but that's just the sort of people we met occasionally.
And what were you doing in that?
The Avengers laid the mines, the fighter boys went ashore, and we flew anti-submarine patrols around the fleet, you see. So we didn't see much. We saw, a couple of German aircraft came over, these Blommenvoss 142, flying boots, they called them, and they were shot down by our fighters before they got any message anywhere ashore. Well, we did this was a few days' trip. Then we went back to Scapa Flow, and by then, this had been about a fortnight altogether, I'd had no clothes, nothing, no, hadn't got a razor, hadn't got any soap, hadn't got a clean collar, anything. So we're in a bit of a state. Anyway, our kit caught up with us there finally in Scapa Flow. But at one other little incident there, I did a fairly heavy landing and strained the undercarriage. So they said, well, while we're here, you better fly ashore to Hudson to pick up another aircraft. And I said, well, what about this one? They said, oh, we'll put a wire strop on it. It'll probably last another landing, they said. So I flew it ashore, landed very gingerly, as you can imagine. I wheeled it on and handed it in and got another aeroplane and came back on. So I actually got another aerodrome landing, to my credit. Well, then we were there for a few days, and then we were sent on a convoy to Russia. Well, there'd been some very hairy ones shortly before. This was October 44, and there'd been 2 or 3 really nasty bad ones before, then quite a few later on. But we were lucky, we had a very quiet one, nothing much happened to us. But it was a curious convoy, because we had two ships, two liners, the Empress of Australia and the Scythia. And we were the Trumpeter was with us again, and our carrier, and the Trumpeter had their full complement of swordfish and wildcats. And we were told we were taking elements of the Norwegian army up to the north of Russia, so when the time came, they could invade Russia from the north. Well, there was a little bit of truth in that. There were some advance party of Norwegian troops on board. But I only found out about 10 years ago, reading an account of this particular convoy, which is known as Operation Golden. It was Convoy 61A, I remember the number. They were taking back Russian prisoners of war who had been fighting in the Ukraine for the German army, and they were going back to Russia for re-education. So you can imagine what was happening to them. So on the way up to Murmansk, we just dashed up about 16 knots all the way, and we didn't do any actually flying on the way, but we sat on the deck ready, so engines running, in case U-boats or anything came, you see.
So what was the main threats, Jack, actually, while you were going up there? What would have been the
U-boats or and land-based aircraft? You see, the Germans had air bases all the way up the coast there. They had these they had bombers, Dorniers and Junkers, and they played havoc with some of the convoys out there. And this ship, the Campania, as I say, lost a few crews on the previous trip, and they'd had quite a few ships sunk. And the convoy after ours as well, there was quite a few ships sunk. But I suppose we were going fast. We went up, and we were lucky, really, in a sense. And there mustn't have been any U-boats about, but we were expecting any time something to happen. Funny thing was, you see, when we went on board, we could have a choice of any cabins we liked, because there was only the sort of eight of us, you see, officers on board. And they said there are some cabins, nice comfortable ones, but they're below the waterline. And when piped down at night, we close all the waterside doors. But if you wish, you can either get a hammock and sleep above, or you can go on the deck if you want to. And Norman and I said, we'll go down below. So we had ourselves battened down every night. No thought about it. Just, not if we'd been torpedoed, we'd never have got out. But at least it was comfortable while we were there, because it was blooming cold, you know. The weather. Imagine.
If you'd have spotted a U-boat in those operations, were there any specific tactics that you would have employed to attack it, other than the ones that you described when you were practising?
Just the same as before, exactly the same, yes. You'd go for it, certainly. You'd have to be careful, because some of the U-boats, the bigger ones, have got quite heavy anti-aircraft guns on board. You know, they could shoot you down if you weren't careful.
Would you actually call up fighter protection for that?
If you spotted one, you'd call in, and they'd probably send other aircraft to follow as a secondary strike, because you're like the spotter there. They said the strike aircraft in, and fighters as well. The fighters too, if there was any, if they did stay to fight on the surface, they could machine gun the gunners on board, you see, and keep the heads down anyway while you did your attack. Again, we were using rockets, which would have been very effective if we had to use them.
And where would the aiming point be if you saw a U-boat on the surface?
Slap bang in the middle, under the conning tower, just aim at the middle of it. Now, they know they worked, because in the... The only I said there was no ship sunk by the back ships. There was one ship, one submarine sunk. It was a Free French one. It surfaced in a danger area and didn't make any signals. Was spotted by a swordfish on patrol for one of the back ships. He flew straight down and put eight rockets through it, and it went down like a rocket. It went down faster than it came up, you know, like a colander. And that's how they proved it worked very well anyway. So that was a bit of hard luck for them.
And what was the chances, obviously, if you ditched in those Arctic waters?
Not much. They told us, in fact, on Campania, they said, if you're coming into land and you crash in the water, we won't stop to pick you up, because you'll be dead by the time you get out of the water. Because we hadn't got immersion suits or anything in those days. Later into 1945, they began to start having immersion suits, which would keep you going for a short while anyway. But they reckoned 4 minutes, they said, winter North Atlantic was your survival time. And we were flying in... pajamas, scapa scanties, which were oiled wool long johns, an oiled wool vest on top of that, a battle dress, a jacket, or a Polarex sweater, and a Sidcut suit, a lining which was like a quilted lining, an Irving suit on top of that, 3 pairs of gloves and 2 helmets, and you're like Michelin Man. But when you got out of the aircraft after a 2.5 hour patrol, you were stiff, absolutely frozen stiff. It was really cold there. Because coming back, we did fly, coming back down, you see, the anti-submarine patrols were further out towards the Atlantic, and went right round Bear Island up north. And I had a nasty experience there, because you're that far north, your magnetic compass doesn't work, the needle touches the bottom of the bowl, so you've got to rely on your gyro. And on our flight out, we flew out onto the course to start the search we'd been sent on, and as I turned, the gyro started spinning. And we lost it, so I had no idea which way I was heading. So there we were, somewhere in the Arctic Ocean, flying in what direction, I don't know. It was beginning to get just a bit dusk. It was October, you see. It was about 3 in the afternoon. And couldn't think what to do, and by the greatest of good fortune, I mean, you know, the Lord is with me, there's no doubt about that, we saw in the distance a wildcat flying past. Now, we were told we weren't allowed to use our radar to get help, you see, but we could use the short-range VHF. So we called him up and said, come alongside, we're lost. And he put his wheels down, his flaps down, to get down slow enough to fly with us. And when he got alongside us, you see, he told us what the course was, and we set the gyro again so we knew the course. And then he gave us the course back to the carrier. But I mean, you know, that is an amazing coincidence, isn't it? You think the one aeroplane flying around that place at the same time. That's probably the most frightening thing that happened to me. That I didn't realise it afterwards, but I had cold sweats later on about that.
What had affected the gyro? Was it just?
Well, I don't know. It just started. It just for some reason decided it precessed. Sometimes they did. Occasionally toppled or something. I don't know whether I moved too quickly or what, but it just toppled and just started spinning round. So there's no way of telling where you are, whether you're going, which way you're going either, because there was no sort of sun. There's just a faint glow in the sky, so you couldn't even tell which was, well, if you did know which was east or south, it wouldn't help much, because the convoy was a fast convoy, dipping along at a rate of knots. So that was a bit of a do. The other funny thing that happened to me on this particular trip, though, when we were in a place called Vianga in Kola Inlet, which is near Murmansk. Incidentally, we were only allowed ashore in a very limited way. The Russians weren't very friendly at all, really. If you walked off the footpath, they sort of lunged at you with some rifles and some machine guns and sort of get back on, you know. Mind, it was a terrible place there. I wouldn't want to live there. There was nothing there at all except frozen sand and scrub birch trees, you know. Oh, like the end of the world. And anyway, I was on duty one night. I was an airman. I wasn't allowed to do any sort of really serious Officer of the Watch stuff, you see, not being competent with a watchkeeping certificate. But I was allowed to do Officer of the Watch in harbour. So while we were tied up, I was Officer of the Watch in harbour, right. And I was told, now, all you've got to do is to make sure that if the captain wants to get ashore, there's a boat available, you see. Otherwise, no problem at all. The Liberty boats go ashore every 40 minutes or so, whatever, every hour. And there was one boat available, a motor cutter, for that. Captain's skimming, his little motorboat was available, and the other main motorboat was out of action, so I had to make sure that, you know, that the other things were right. Okay, I was fine. Well, the captain sent me a message. I'm not going ashore. You can use my boat for anybody you like. So the surgeon commander came up to me. Now, he was an interesting chap. He retired as a surgeon rear admiral and come back in again as a commander for wartime service. He was an elderly gent with grey hair, probably a bit younger than I am now, but to me he was an ancient. And he said, can I borrow a boat to go ashore? I said, certainly, sir. I said, the captain doesn't want it. So he gave him the motorboat and off he went. Well, that was all very well, till about half an hour later, up comes the commander. I'm going ashore, I'll have the motorboat. Oh, sorry, sir, it isn't available. What? Oh, God. So he ate me alive, you see. So he had to go in the Liberty boat with all the Liberty men in the motor cutter. He wasn't at all happy, stomped up and down, snorting through his nostrils. Anyway, when the boat, he got down, the usual thing, you know, the senior officer gets on board last and gets out first. So he went down and got in the boat and sat in the stern seats of the boat as they pulled away from the side, and I tried to pretend nothing about it. And then I could hear a coughing sound, and look, and then the boat's engine had stopped. It was drifting. And there was the coxswain in the back, reaching over the stern, pulling away at something, you see. And apparently, the propeller got fouled on something. And there's the boat drifting away, and it was dusk. And there was a vague sort of orange glow in the sky, and I could see silhouetted against the sky this figure of the commander standing in the stern sheets, shaking his fist at me, getting smaller as he drifted towards the Barents Sea. And I thought, well, after about 20 minutes, they got an old sack or something, got rid of the propeller, they got it off again. But for the rest of the time on board the ship, whenever the commander came in the wardroom, I left. I missed a few meals that way.